But tonight I am delighted to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and Tea Teresa Tadouri, artist, performer, writer, songwriter, and KOWS FM radio host. And she's going to be singing, speaking the spirit and singing the soul this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm so shocked that people are here. I'm very grateful to you. I'm really happy to see everybody, and thank you so much. There's some wonderful musicians in here, and artists and writers and dancers and all sorts of talent in this room. And I felt tonight very moved to talk about this with you. Because I feel like our generation, and there's everybody's about the same age, 36, that we've been on a journey, and I've been thinking a lot, and I'm sure you have too. I'm sure you have. What the fuck is going on? What is happening in our world, and why am I here now? And as an artist, what am I doing? What is my role? What is my job? What does it mean to be an artist in these times and in this culture? I don't know if you ask yourself that. I'm pretty sure you probably do. And is anybody listening? Do I have something important to say? Am I affecting a change in the world? Am I contributing? What is the nature of my contribution? How should it be? Thank you.
Hi.
And I would be really foolish if I were to tell you that I was up here to give a lecture or something and enlighten you in any way about anything, because we're peers and we're all involved in our respective disciplines, and most of us have used those respective disciplines as our spiritual path. Eventually it becomes that. Maybe before, earlier in our lives, perhaps we view it differently. So I just want to talk a little bit about my own path in that way and see if you relate to me. And then we'll talk about what's going on now as artists and what we're doing. So who knows? When I was a child, when I was very young, I knew I was a musician. It was like knowing I was gay, you know? It's the same thing. You know that you're a little different. Did anybody have that experience that you knew you were something was a little calibrated, a little strangely, a little differently, that you feel not quite in the groove with everybody, yeah. And you had something else kind of going on, and you weren't sure what it was, you know, but you knew.
No, you're the only one.
No, I knew I was the only one. I had a feeling. Well, when I was a kid, you know, I was already born a musician. I was born singing. You know, there are pictures of me in nursery school singing to the other kids at, it's ridiculous, this picture of I'm like, Mammy, you know, during nap time, you know, and I got my arms out, and I'm doing this thing, and I'm like this tall, and the other kids are all trying to sleep, and so there was definitely a calling, right? And it was so, we're talking about knowing very early on that you're a musician or you're a writer or that there's something stirring in your soul before you have a chance to articulate what it is. If you were raised by people the way I was raised, the people I was raised by were not enlightened beings, I don't think. I mean, Arthur and Gladys were pain in the ass from the minute I got to life. You know, I was glad they drank a lot, because being an alcoholic myself, it was great to know where I could get a drink. You know, early on, and my dad used to take me out of school for baseball games and things at 10 and 11. We're going to the game. So everybody talks about the downside of alcoholism. Everybody talks about the upside. You know? I got to go to the game on. But my parents were not in a position to be, you know, edifying or supportive, because they were working out their own things that they weren't able to look at from a distance, to pull back and get that kind of distance that we're so lucky in our generation to have gotten. We've gotten such an ingress of spiritual knowledge and help, not only through through, you know, the generations of teachings that we have access to, which we're no longer, it's no longer an esoteric thing, that these lessons are everywhere for us, these teachers are everywhere, the internet, television, everything. We've been accelerating at such an enormous pace that anybody and everybody has these things available to them now, and has ways to access, you know, the deeper stirrings in their heart. There will be availability for them. But my job, what is my job as an artist, what is our job as people who are in touch somewhat, is to remind others of who they really are. I think that's the bottom line. But also to remind each other who we really are, and that we're perhaps spiritual beings having a physical experience, and that we all have this in common, and this is the driving force of love itself, to know and respect and understand that each person's journey is fraught with peril. It's interesting, it's always the lesson of coming to becoming authentic, hopefully eventually, in the face of everything that tries to keep us asleep and keeps us hypnotized and keeps us, you know, mired in anything and everything that would keep us away from that journey, that endeavor. You know, the pharmaceutical companies now are hugely invested in keeping us all completely fucked up. I'm sorry, I don't have a better word for it, you know. Asleep, deadened, you know, unable to walk through the dignity of our own challenges. You know, what is the soul's walk? Is to be depressed. You get depressed. I don't trust anybody who doesn't have a complete breakdown in this life at some point. Yeah, I don't trust him. If somebody isn't going, ah, you know. But if you remove people's ability to have their experiences and to flatline everybody, you know, then we have a bunch of people who are truncated, who don't walk through these things and are repressed and continue to come up against a brick wall, as far as I can tell. That's my take on it. I think maybe I'm talking too much. I probably should sing a song and then, you know, and talk about where that song came from a little bit. But I'll just start with this little story about trying to arrive at a place where I could be a musician in this culture, in this life. And I was 12. My dad said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" You know, and I said, "A musician." And he said, "Oh, well, be done with it and hang the red light over your door now."
Oh.
And I wasn't sure what that meant. I was 12, so I figured, you know, red light stop, you know, green light go. I have to wait for the light to turn before I can, you know. And when I realized what he meant, it was really shocking. You know, my dad was born in 1899 in the French Quarter, Louisiana, in New Orleans, and that's my family's all on that side, are all from there. So my dad was Victorian. I mean, Edwardian, I think. No, actually, Victorian. And so his attitude was to be, you know, he was horrified at the idea that he would have a daughter who would, you know, go into show business. And that put me in a real quandary, because I had already been chosen to be a musician. It's, you know, I've been chosen. I was already one. You know in your heart when you are, or you're a painter, or you're whatever you are, you know. And it's the sort of hit by lightning gig, you know. So it put me in a weird position. And I had to sort of sneak being a musician. He wanted me to take piano lessons and violin lessons, maybe flute. That would be all. But I wanted to play the blues, and I knew that right away. I wanted to play the blues, and I thought the black culture was much more interesting. And And so it wasn't until, and then also I knew there was something very, very wrong with his thinking. You know, because I didn't equate making music with something that would be degrading. But I also didn't have a cultural image of, outside of opera stars or concert musicians, of an image of the feminine that was actualized and realized as a musician, as writers and performers either. You know, we came through the folk rock era and we had, you know, people like Janis Joplin and pardon me?
I said, what's your name?
Yeah, what's her name? Gracie Slick and, you know, these girls. I got drunk with Janis, actually. I was 17 and she came to see me at the Coffee Gallery in North Beach in San Francisco and took me out. And we went out, and I'll tell you that story later. And I loved her. She was wonderful. She was very, very bright, extremely bright, and very sensitive. And all the bells and the whistles were really a protective mechanism. We can see, we can all see that now. You know, we can look at her and realize. But she was very, very kind to me. And her death really affected me terribly. You know, because it taught me something about the culture itself and what it was demanding of this iconic sort of people who had to carry the projections, and that also was something I rejected, but I didn't have anywhere to go. There's nowhere for the artist to go in our culture. They show us these kids get commandeered before they even realize what a sacred, you know, a covenant they have going if they can just make it, if someone will show them that. So fast forward to the Monterey Jazz Festival, in whenever that was, where Janis was playing and Ravi Shankar was there. So I hitchhiked there. I don't know how we survived ourselves, you know. I hitchhiked to that, to Monterey Jazz Festival, and Ravi Shankar was there. And this was the first introduction that we were getting to Eastern music. As you all recall, it was overwhelming, and it was just fantastic, you know. And so I had this very close seat to Ravi Shankar, and he was playing with Ali Akbar Khan, was doing the drumming, and I can't remember who the sarood player was, but they were the ace guys from India, you know. And he played this raga, and we were all transfixed. I mean, we really were. Everybody, and I never forget the feeling. I even remember where I was sitting and where I was in the audience. And when he finished, and I don't know how long it was. It didn't seem long, but, you know, it was wonderful. There was this moment of silence before everybody erupted into applause. It was one of those moments, you know, where everything has been so transportive and beautiful and overwhelming that you don't have to take a moment. And then everyone rose to their feet and applauded like mad, you know. And he didn't acknowledge us. He looked up to God or whatever and acknowledged that first. And then he acknowledged the audience. And then that's when I knew that that's what it was about. Uh-huh. That's what it's about. My dad was wrong. And Ravi Shankar was my dad. You know, that was my spiritual father. And that music itself was meant to be in support of the inner understanding of one's divinity. And the remembrance of one's divinity, and that the job of the musician and the artist, I think, is to deliver that memory. But how the, you know, does it sell records? You know, this is a question for people. I mean, that was my intuition at the time, that the job of the artist was to carry the memory of the inner dialogue with the divine. And it comes out in the music and in the voice. The body remembers, you know. And it comes out in with the painter or the dancer, that, you know, when you see with dancers, you can see the connection to the spirit, you know, but you watch it physically happening. great art always to me is reflective of the inner dialogue that the artist is having with his or her connection. And then to be able to deliver that in performance, then that to me is what it's about. So I had that intuition, but it's taken me all the time on the planet that I've had to hopefully approach that in performance, you know, to remember. Now, I don't know what your experience of me is. You know, I can't know what that is. But I know what I have to try and bring to a stage when I have it, and where I try and come from when I'm working. And that's always from that place within where I'm the first audience, I'm the first listener. You know, sometimes I get confused when I'm on stage and I get, for instance, sometimes when I'm playing, I'll look out and I'll see somebody yawning or somebody looking at with a scowly look, and I think, oh, that guy hates me. And then I start to, I'm no good, and I start to spin off, you know, the monkey mind will start and say, what the fuck do you think you're doing anyway? And then you start, and you went to earth to open it. And then every performer's had that experience. You know, you just can't help it. You're a human being up there, and, you know, the monkey mind is always, you know, after you. But then the only thing to do in such a moment for me is to listen to the note that's going to come next. You know, get back way, way into the sound I'm going to make or the next word that I say, and get into how does that, and really hook back in, because otherwise I'm lost. If it's about me and how do I look, and mm-hmm. and do you like me, and am I going to get a record deal out of this, or just shoot me now, just shoot me now. And there are a lot of people who live their life in the artistic world with that as their, and we can't blame them. You know, we can't blame them because we've held this up as the only model or image that we have for successful artistry in our culture. One of the things that I think is so important for artists is that one of the things that we do, when we look at the ancient Greeks, so wonderful at this, and this is what we've lost because our artistic work has been commandeered, as I say, by big corporations for young people. It used to be sort of, we could remember when the artists were the kind of the hip ones that would come out and kind of steer the culture a little bit. Now it's the opposite. Now you turn on something like The Voice or, you know, what is these things, these competitive vocalese things that they get these kids into, and they'll take a perfectly wonderful raw talent and then just all of a sudden their hair is out to here, and you know, and they've got them completely airbrushed and sounding like everybody else with this huge orchestral and with these big, you know, orgasmic musical crescendos that everyone's singing their guts out. And I don't think that's what, you know, we're supposed to be doing. I think the artist goes fishing and hunting deep into the psyche and comes back with sort of the collective images, you know, of the culture itself, and puts them in a form and weaves them and tells a story and brings up what's repressed and hidden from us in daily life, and brings it up into a form that we can digest it. There's so much repression. A lot of energy is used to not look at what we don't want to see about ourselves, and the artist brings that all up to the light, because this is healthy. This is what helps the culture to continue to, you know, to the blood to run and the oxygen to get to the body of the culture itself. It has to regenerate and rejuvenate itself by addressing the toxins or the repressed information that is all a bunch of energy. I mean, everything that we, all the energy we spend to not look, you know, doesn't, that energy must come up. It surges up. It's called the midlife crisis where you have a persona and you want the persona to be, you know, everything. And so you just keep putting what you don't want to look at in this big sack, you know, because you say, oh, no, I'm this, I'm that, I'm this. And then all of a sudden the sack is like, and you're about 47, 5, and the sack is so fucking heavy you can't lift it anymore, and it pulls you back into a crisis of some kind that forces you to acknowledge your soul. And then your soul hopefully takes ascendancy and moves the persona out of the way, the ego out of the way, and says, okay, stand back. We have to live an authentic life. If you're lucky, that's what will happen in a crisis, will be the result. The artist does that for you in a way on a daily basis. The artist is constantly bringing up the repressed and bringing it into the light. And he does it in a palatable way, you know, so that we can, you know, we can ingest in bits and pieces, maybe we can move along without having to completely blow up. The Greeks were great at this. The Greeks would come to a big amphitheater and watch this guy, you know, agonizing over the fact that he had intercourse with his mother, killed his dad, you know, blinded himself because he didn't want to know that that's what he was about, you know what I mean? And what an idea, you know, or they go, yeah, great, pass the, you know, kifteles, you know, Demetrius. I don't know why. But you can imagine, you know, how much energy was released because this is a myth that nobody wants to look at the idea that they're sexually interested in their mother or their father, or, you know, this is taboo information, you know, this is, and here it is, becomes a drama. And a whole Greek group would go down and watch this thing, and they would experience what's called a catharsis. This is an enormous release of energy, because what cannot be said, what cannot be spoken, what is not allowed, is allowed there within the context of this very safe arena and a beautiful atmosphere outside, and everybody can go, yeah, and what's his name, Oedipus gets to carry the whole wreck. Oedipus gets to carry the wreck into the woods. And everybody feels so much better, you know, because all this stuff has been up and out, all that repression is released. And when you release that kind of repression, when that kind of thing comes into consciousness as it's allowed, all this energy is up for other things, like, you know, beautiful diaphanous togas and things, and beautiful the Corinthian Ionic and Doric columns. I remember that from somewhere. And the idea of democracy. You know, can you imagine such a fantastic idea as this beautifully creative idea of how human beings could exist? And I think that it came from that culture, because that culture was pretty healthy. It was constantly examining itself, and it nurtured its artists to do so. They were very, very nurturing of their artists. And when I lived in Greece several years ago, in the island of Idri, you would ask a Greek person, you know, what they did, and they'd say, "Oh, I'm a kalitechnika, and then I'm the police chief." So they're saying basically, "I write poetry, and I also am a fisherman." You know, their gig always came after their art form. It's still the same there. Very healthy. So those are some ideas about art and what we maybe might, what I certainly try to aspire in my work, though I don't take a hammer out onto the stage and ever say anything like this. This is nothing I would talk about from the stage too much. You know, I don't know if anybody would find it interesting. I don't know if you find it interesting. I'm a little concerned right now, but
But I thought I'd take a little chance on it. I teach a writing class at a thing called Summer Song, a music writing class, and it always gets down to, why do you do it? Why do you want to be on stage? What are you trying to say to people? What's your motivation? And, you know, a lot of people have no idea. They just know that they have to do it. They want to. A lot of people are looking for validation. I certainly was too. You know, there's no question that we look for that. You know, we have egos and we have deficiencies from our childhood. So many of us were not nurtured or loved as children. And I think it's more and more in our culture how difficult it is to find actual adults anymore. We don't have hallmarks anymore as to how to mature or what it means to arrive at a level of maturity and then move to the next. We don't have that. We don't have sacredness too much in our world. You know, all of these, we were tribal people. You know, they say a wedding party is about 200 folks, that we were used to kind of being in tribal communities together, and that there would always be somebody sort of in charge of helping with the matriculation of a person's consciousness. It was usually the shaman. And the shaman's job was an interesting job. You couldn't decide you wanted to be the shaman. You couldn't walk in and say, well, I think I'll be shaman this week. And that was another hit by lightning gig. You know, you were appointed. The other people, the other shamans knew who you were. It goes on in lineages in Tibet still, you know, where they know. And that shaman's job was, because everybody else was out beating the bushes trying to get enough berries and food and all the things you had to do. So it was a rarefied position. It still is. And I think it's the artist's position in our culture now to take the temperature of the culture, to bring up what's repressed, bring it to the light, and to dispel it somewhat and give us all, you know, this is what keeps a culture healthy. So I'm going to sing a song now. And I have a bunch of new things, a few things that I'd love to play, which are just sacred songs that have come through. But I thought I'd do Mrs. God, just for the hell of it, you know, because it's kind of, we're kind of talking about things that feel repressed. And this woman definitely is not. And not, I'm not speaking, when I say this woman, I mean the woman in the song. Has a voice that's kind of different than mine, but still. So. Okay. I talk about sacred music. And, I'm a real fan of all the. I love Tibetan Buddhism particularly. Very big love of that. I've been doing the Green Tara Mantra for the last couple of weeks. And I have the Dalai Lama doing it for me, you know, on a tape loop so I can hear how he can say it. He's a wonderful singer, too. Have you ever heard him? Yeah. And I love Jesus. Just love him. I don't know how that happened. But I got sober 30 years ago. I'm sober almost 30 years, 29 and three quarters. And he came to me in a vision. I was supposed to tell my story at an AA meeting, and I was 6 months sober. And I just thought, I can't do this. Now, I've done it one day at a time now for 30 years, so you can do it. I could do it. But I just, at that point, I said, there's just no way I can get up and tell my story. I need a drink. for me to do this. I didn't have to get fucked up to be able to tell my story. Yeah. And somebody said, well, come on, you're an artist, you're a singer, you're used to being on stage. And I'm used to being drunk in bars singing, you know, something. No, I'm not used to telling my story. And I was very, very sure that I was going to have to go out and drink. And I was on this roof in Valencia Street at a friend's house, just out of my mind with terror. And I was closing my eyes thinking, how can I get through this? How can I do this? And all of a sudden I had this vision, this image, and Jesus appeared. and I thought, oh, Christ. It was the last thing I want. You know, this is, please, with the Jesus. Oh, no. It was bad enough. I'm sober. And I have Jesus now. This was like horrible. So, and there was no words. There was nothing going on at all. But him looking at me. And there was this moment he's standing there and he's looking at me. He's got the robes and the sandals. You know, he's got the full Cleveland. And I'm standing next to him, and he gestures to this vision of me, and I'm cowering in a corner, and I'm just terrified, and just, you know, just crouching, and I can see myself in this vision of myself, just terrified, not just of giving my story, but of everything, just of everything. And then he shows me this. He says, you could have that. Basically, he's not speaking to me. It's all mental. He says, you can have that, or you can have this. And there's this door, and it opens into this luminosity, and it's endless luminosity, and there's no top, there's no bottom. There's just infinite, gorgeous light emanating. And he sort of gestures for me to walk through the door into this light. And I think, well, easy for you, how, you know, to stand in the light like that. I could fall, and then who are you anyway? You could have been sent from Central, you could be a rapist, you could be a mugger, I don't know, in a Jesus suit. You know, I'm thinking like this. And but something says go through, and so I do, and I'm standing there in the light with him for this moment. And he puts out his arms like this, as if to say, you know, join me. And so I put my arms on top of his, and I'm looking. And this is very, the moment he looked me in the eye, deeply into my eyes. And I had this incredible sense of absolute, unconditional love. Like nothing in this world I've ever experienced ever before, since it was fathomless, it was endless, and just so dear. And then all of a sudden he sort of winked at me, and he goes like this, and off we go, and we polka in the light. We just poke in the light, and his robes are going, you know, and his sandals are flapping, you know, and I'm running out, and it was fantastic. And I sat up, you know, because I had, it was really like a hallucination, and I sat up, you know, and I thought, oh my, and I was laughing and crying at the same time, because I was so touched by this experience of this great master who'd come to be just a wonderfully loving helper, you know, from that, with no ego. The guy had no investment at all other than just love. And then to dance around like that was just so goofy that I knew that I had been spoken to in the language of my heart that I would have loved the most, which was irony. That he was ironic with me made me know that he had spoken to me personally. You know, that he had got my number and would use that to. So that has made me really like the guy a lot ever since. That I'm so upset as how he's been commandeered by people who would know more, poor people who are frightened and have no more idea of what I think the message was to begin with, and which was And I promise you, I feel I have the right to say this, that I may be wrong, and, you know, maybe we'll get a nice bolt of lightning through my nose or something. But I promise you, I'm sure that he never said, I am the only Son of God. I know that he said we all were. And this and greater things than this shall you do. I mean, there's no question in my mind that that was the article, the main, you know, the main... And that's why he had to go. Because when we know who we are, who we really are, then the power of that is just overwhelming. No one can turn us into consumers. You can't be turned into slave. You can't be enslaved. You can't become a mindless eater, or whatever they call us. You can't. You are empowered in such a magnificent way. Because that's who we are. So I think I'll play this song first, which is the song I wrote for Jesus. And then I'll play Mrs. God. This is something I've never done in public, so let's see how we do it. My cat loves it.
He loved the sea. The folks he took out fishing were much like you and me. One day he went missing, some said forever lost, gone. But somehow we felt differently, prayed he'd prove them wrong. When he comes back again, he will come back and then again. There'll be no more religion. That will all be done. The end of division will finally have some fun. The birds will sweetly sing as they are meant to do. There'll be plenty to go around, enough for me and you. When he comes back again, he'll come back and then we will all remember who we really are when he comes back again. Him to a store and fit him out much better than we did before. We'll stand there in the mirror reflecting some side by side, the light that blazes within us, that we no more will hide. When he comes back again, he'll come back, and then we will all remember who we really are when he comes back again.
Dear friend Kim Tripp Smith just came in. She's a wonderful musician and producer of great things, and is working at the Diana Center. If you haven't caught that up there, that's wonderful. So I'd like to sing Mrs. God for You Now. I wrote this when I was sitting up in my my shack in the woods in Occidental, and was thinking about God. And what an interesting God he is. That's mostly the woman speaking directly to the patriarchal God of the Old Testament. And the one that is an interject for all of us, even though we may, you know, be more fuzzy, you know, born again Zen Druid Shinto pagan, and we might have a more amorphous, loving whatever or nothing out there, whatever. But this is the one, you know, the old God, that the one that makes sure no matter how good a time you're having, you won't enjoy it. That one. Okay, the old. Dad is drunk again, God. The one that smites, yeah, and smites and votes and... I think maybe I need a capo for this. La 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 la. La 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 la. The Bible says for certain that you are in fact a man, and I'd say you've got great taste for a guy. You've made mountains and rivers and the luscious scent of roses, and I just love what you've done with the sky. However, it appears you've too much time on your hands, for you're creating many things that we don't need, like pestilence and warfare and
and a lot of bad diseases, and a whole bunch of people we can't feed. I've been trying to call you almost daily. Do not make me come to your home. I'm fierce, believe me. If you want to relieve me, then put Mrs. God on the phone. Put Mrs. God on the phone. We all know men in our lives without the benefit of wives who pull some crazy shit completely on their own. But a fellow of your stature could never be a bachelor. So come on, put Mrs. God on the phone. I've examined all the scriptures with their tenets and their strictures, and I wonder who died and made you born. For with your twisted sense of management, it's hard to contain the damage when you nail your best employees to a cross. She must be right up to her eyeballs, trying to maintain some order at home. And there are no friends with which to hobnob when you're married to a whack job. Sacrifice, these bloody battles just aren't nice. A woman would create a friendlier tone. And with your tired little point of view, a full big gap and no still who just put God on the phone. Who knows, she might have some really good ideas.
Some of the I stop pretty soon, don't I? Have,
oh no!
No, I have one. Right. I won't go too long. In keeping with some of this, some of the story, the backstory about Ravi Shankar, for instance, and knowing that there was a sacredness in the endeavor and in the work that had to be found, and I couldn't find it in the world that I was going into as a young artist. I just kept being, and people would try and help me. I really had a remarkable help my whole life. When I look back, I think I'm one of the luckiest people alive that I've had probably what would not be considered an easy life. And I think I should maybe talk about how I got to Sevastopol a little bit. But one of the things was when the inauthenticity of the persona is so far, so wrongly developed, in my case, I didn't realize that I looked on every way like a decent person. I was very devoted to my art form. I was doing good things in the world. You know, I showed up and I was a spiritual spiritually interested, always had been, so I always had a discipline, so it seemed, and I worked really hard at being here. But I had a very serious illness in 2002. One of the things is I was working too hard to be here. A lot of people, if at core you don't feel like you belong, or that you need to improve yourself somehow, or that you don't deserve, or that you're shame-based, or so many of us have these core issues that, you know, it's ridiculous. So many of us, you know, and that you feel like you have to earn your place on the planet. And I was definitely in that category, so I worked way too hard at being decent and good and in the light. You know, I wanted to be a light worker, so I only wanted to see the light, and you stepped on my foot, I forgave you before I said, ouch. You know what I mean? I was too good. And I wasn't integrated. I think that's when I look back, I can realize that my shadow self was being repressed, and it would come through in the music, and it started to come through in a very kind of spooky way. I was just talking about that in one of the CDs that I did, some of the music started to become very dark indeed, and it was frightening me a little bit. And then a confluence of things happened, and I had what's like a stroke. It's called global trauma, and it's your nervous system basically blows up, which has happened, and people die from it. It's a very unusual event, but you know, everything kind of blows up, and I started spiraling down, and all my body started shutting down, all the everything, and it took about 3 months of this spiral until I was so sick that I was dying, and I had to finally, you know, get help. I came back to my family, and they put me in a hospital. I was in the hospital for about 3 months. And I lost everything. I was at kind of the height of my career at that time. I was doing very well. I was working on lots of different people's, projects in Los Angeles. I worked with a lot of famous people that you know, and I did all sorts of stuff. And I had a very nice seminar business. It was going into its fourth year. I was working at a hospital as a drug and alcohol counselor, and family counselor, so I was a very, very busy person. And I had my band of 12 years that I felt very incumbent upon me to keep them working. They, you know, they were very dependent, not totally dependent on me for a living, but certainly a good chunk of it came from our work together. I felt very obliged to keep everybody, you know, working. So I had maybe too much going on. And when I got sick, I lost everything. I mean, absolutely everything, including my friends and my support system, because no one knew what was happening to me for the longest time. No one knew. And to see somebody to go down that horribly in such flames, people thought maybe I was using drugs or something had happened to me, because it was a spiral down. The hospitalization was difficult, and when I came out, I didn't know who I was. I couldn't remember how to play my guitar. I couldn't talk. I could talk, but it wasn't it wasn't anything anybody wanted to listen to particularly. And I looked horrible. And I had to come back from ground zero. So it took a long time. And it's taken a while. I don't know why I'm telling you this, but I think every time I talk about it, it seems like I'm supposed to. So, mm-hmm. So somehow, I wound up here in Sebastopol. After I got out of the hospital, it took me a long time. I went to my brother, then to my sister for a short time, and then to a very, very dear friend in Chico, who is my friend since second grade. And she refused to let me go down. I was truly felt like I shouldn't live. And she just refused. She just kept looking at me saying, "You're Teresa. You're Teresa. And you'll get through this. We're getting through this. We're getting through this." And she just refused to let me, you know, forget. So I don't know.
And then I had an old boyfriend, George Forrester, who kept calling me. He said we hadn't spoken in many years. We'd broken up in 95, and he called and said, I heard you aren't well. Do you mind if I call you? And I said, there's no Teresa here. She's dead. You know, she's gone. I don't know who she is. Talking like this. And he said, well, I'll remember for you. And he called me every night for 2 years.
Oh, my God.
And another man I'd never met in my life, Fred in Alabama, he called me because he wanted me to come speak at a convention. And I said, well, Teresa Taddeuri is dead. That's what I told him on the phone. I said, I'm here now. Really, literally, that's what I said. And I'm answering for her, but I can't be her. He said, well, I've heard your tapes, and I want to just talk to you. Do you mind if I... So he called me. So he called me every night, and then he'd say, it's George's turn, and I'd say, good night, Fred. I don't even know. I don't remember the conversations. All I know is that I'm indebted to these two people who are angels to me. I got a job from a fan of mine who heard some music, who loved my work, and loved her. And she had this kind of greasy spoon in San Francisco, so she gave me a job. Nobody else would have given me a job. I couldn't shuffle my feet. My motor nerves weren't very good, and I wasn't talking very well. And I looked like, you know, a weed on fire. So I'd shuffle him. Hello, I'm your waitress. Nosferatu. You know, hello. What would you have? I could do it. So I don't know why, but she gave me this job, and I was there for a year waiting tables, and you know, it was the worst feeling ever because I'd had this life that had taken me years to build, and that was gone, and nobody knew, and I was waiting these tables. Well, okay, it was wonderful. It was hard because I wasn't sure I was going to survive during those times, but it was wonderful to see the humanity that I had missed. I was so persona-driven in Los Angeles. I was so looking to the big people, the stars, the whatever, thinking that this was going to do it or that was going to do it, that I missed everything. And the heroism of the busboys and the waitresses from the Philippines and the cooks and the people who cleaned and everybody, all of a sudden I was back, I was where I belonged. I was in humanity and I was part of, and it was very, very painful because it was a struggle just to be there, but it was the lesson I needed, you know, to be authentically myself, to become authentically human, and to see. One busboy came up to me, it was the end of the day, and the waitresses would tip out to the busboys. He'd been a busboy for 23 years. And he was taking care of his Alzheimer's mother, and he'd call her, he'd go right home from work and take care of his mother, and he called her his baby. I have to go home and take care of my baby. Baby needs me. I have to go. You know, so we'd have to hurry up and tip him. And one night I was tipping him, and he said, oh, no, no, you didn't make enough money tonight. You didn't make enough money. He knew that, you know, my tips weren't good, so he wasn't going to take. I mean, that's better than some millionaire coming in and plopping a $1,000 tip on the table. This guy was working for minimum wage and taking care of his Alzheimer's mother and doesn't want to inconvenience me or hurt me, my... And I thought, this is a bodhisattva. This is the guys that nobody sees. These are the people who live, you know, who are doing the big, heavy lifting. And I missed all of that. I was missing all of that. After a while, I saw a sign for a trauma expert. My boss had a house in Guerneville, and she'd let me come up sometimes. And I saw a sign for a trauma expert. So I read what she talked about in her blurb on this flyer. And I said, that's what happened to me. You know, the electric explosion in my brain and all the stuff that went on. And I went to hell, you know. And I thought, my God, I wonder if she can help me. So I started coming up to Sebastopol to see this therapist. And once I got into the light of Sebastopol and into the draw of the beauty, I thought, if I don't come back to nature, I won't make it. I'm not going to survive. I could feel that. I knew it was it. And so I started plotting as to how I could get here.
Now, I still didn't look really great, and you know, I was still pretty weird. But I would come up and down the street, and I met Honor at your little store here. Yeah, and Honor was in this little store, and she had this beautiful white dog named Spirit. And I just love animals, and the animals were trying to get me back. I had all sorts of animals that I would, and Spirit was one of my favorite guys, and Honor was okay too. Honor was great, and Honor's, and I talked to her a little bit about it, and I think I started to tell you about my story, and she said, "Well, you should go next door to Many Rivers Bookstore. This is 2004 or 5. Go to Many Rivers Bookstore. You should find a book by a woman named Ginny Matthews, who is lecturing." And I think your story is something Ginny would relate to. So I came next door, and you were sitting with Ginny, I think. And I came in looking for Ginny Matthews. I said, "Do you know a woman named Ginny Matthews?" And Ginny goes, "I'm Ginny Matthews." And well, this woman next door said, "I should tell my story to you." And Ginny was amazing. She sat there and she held this place for this big story. And then she mentioned that she was... Is that ever going to go off? Do we know that is?
Somebody saw.
Do you know where that music's coming from?
A cell phone, I would have meant.
Oh, good. Yeah. It's good. So,
All right, so...
It was nice.
Yeah.
So Ginny and I started talking. We were holding a place. She was holding a place for me, and I wasn't sure if I was just... And then she mentioned that she was a Buddhist and that she sat with her Roshi in Mount Baldy. And I said, "Well, I have a friend at Mount Baldy. His name is Leonard." And she said, "Leonard Cohen?" And I said, "Yes." Leonard Cohen kind of had picked me up as a kid when I was in my early 20s and tried to take care of me and my career. Well, that's another story. We're friends. He's wonderful. So when Ginny knew that I was friends with Leonard and I knew she was, we had this nice moment, and she asked me what I had done, and I said, "Well, I was a singer. And I had my guitar in the back, but I wasn't singing."
Do you remember what you said to me?
No.
Because it was very important. You talked about you were a singer.
Yeah.
And then you stopped and you looked at me. And I have a really remarkable voice.
I said that?
You said that. And I said, "Yay, someone is standing up for her talent." Uh-huh. And I said, "Well, I want to hear it." And you said, "I have a guitar in the car," and I said, "Well, we're going to my studio and you're going to sing to me."
Yeah, she made me sing. So.
And she did.
Yeah, and I did. And I didn't want to particularly. I did and I didn't. I was scared, but I played for you. Mm-hmm. And then Ginny said, "Well, why don't you..." By this time I was living here in Sebastopol. I got in a room on Mill Station Road, and I got in a room with a bunch of people, with other women. It was like I was a college student. I left my waitress job. I'd saved my tips and I moved up here. And I got a room. I had to start all over again like a kid. And I got a room in this house and I got a job delivering mushrooms. There was this mushroom gig where we delivered mushrooms to restaurants. And I got this gig delivering mushrooms. I'm not sure how I got it. But and Ginny heard me sing, and then she said, "I have a recital. My kids are going to dance. Would you sing this song, your song for?" And everything in me was screaming no, because I didn't feel I was ready. I didn't think I looked good. You know, I was still very compromised, I felt, from my illness. I didn't want anyone looking at me, and I didn't know anybody. But I thought, the voice said, "If you, this is a, the door, I knew you must go through it. You know, if you're going to come back, this is what you have to do.
And so I played for Ginny's recital, and it was wonderful. And I've been playing ever since. So the two women were very important to me. I wonder if this story is doing anything. I hope it's being of some service to you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise I feel like I'm just doing this, and I don't want to just do that. The prayer is when you're going, and I think this is one of the things about talking about challenges and about the work of an artist and meeting challenges, is we all meet them in our lives. Everyone has challenges that they will be presented with that you might not feel that you have the you don't have the resources to think. That's exactly the word I was looking for. I put the garbage in the refrigerator the other day. It's making me wonder about it. You don't have the resources to meet. And when you have one of these challenges that you simply cannot meet, and then another force greater than yourself kind of takes over and pulls you through. That's one of the surrenders that we make in this life. And I think we're asked to make that a lot, because the real joy in the journey is the surrender. It's difficult, but the constant surrender to the higher level of consciousness, I think now is what we're all being called upon, because humanity has hit the burden. The egoic burden is now so heavy that we've destroyed the planet and we can't continue. And so I think all of us are being asked to wake up from the nightmare of the personal story, to transcend that personal story and embrace not only our humanity but also that power within us that is so far greater than the little storylines themselves. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're all being asked that now. I think what are we doing on the planet now? Why are we here now, and what's our job? And I think as artists, as writers, as performers, that's the name of the game, that humanity is being quickened and we're being asked to do this. I know in my personal life a lot of old stuff is coming up, and it's time to, and I don't want to go through that. I don't want to have to, it could be, I've been through therapy, I've been through this, I've been through, why do these things, these old resentments keep coming? Why do I have to keep recycling this crap, Why? And it's because it's up to meet it. To meet it with the only thing that can meet it, which is that higher consciousness in which all of that dissolves. And practicing that in front of the very people who've hurt us the most is such a great gift. But it's hard. It's not fun. But it has to be achieved, I think, if we're going to get past this very, very difficult legacy in the human experiment. Where we have to be able at some point to transcend the very things that keep us locked in this dance of death with each other. So everybody, if you have a lot of challenge coming up right now in those areas, I would offer that it's great. You're being asked to move through it and move with it. I think I'll play you a song. I've been working on the banjo.
So ridiculous.
I shall now attempt to tune the banjo. So many fools have in the past. You can't imagine before the advent of the tuner how musicians used to just kill each other. You're flat. No, you're sharp. No, you're flat. Now this simple little device. I was thinking about all of these themes that we're talking about tonight, and I was thinking, how the heck, you know, how do we arrive at consciousness? And I have a propensity for pulling in people with narcissistic personality disorder. I've done this my whole life. Has anybody here ever had an experience with narcissism, with a narcissist? You have? You have? Yeah, NPD, it's called narcissistic personality. It's the crazy maker of all time. You pull one of these people in, they get you by lionizing you, and then they get you, and then slowly they start to demean you, and then they discard you until they can come back. You know, it's a horrible, horrible thing. And I've had them in business partners and gurus and lovers. You know, it's just unbearable. And finally, they can drain you. You get, it's like a vampire. You're laughing. You know, you've experienced this. Have you experienced this? It's unbelievable. You have to experience it. And I thought, what's wrong with me? You know. And finally, I pulled one of these suckers in about 4 years ago. I called him a succupath. And and the thing is, you have to look at yourself, because there's obviously something really not right. You know, if that's because there's millions of people out there. You know, you keep getting the same thing over and over again. So it's obviously there's something going on. So finally, I had been involved with this person, and a therapist friend of mine said, well, he's a narcissist, for Christ's sake. That's how they are. They're narcissists. Come on! Like, you're an idiot. And it was like, holy shoot. And I started to unravel this for myself. And I found out about narcissistic personality disorder and other sociopathic, experiences of that nature. And I realized that I had been raised by one. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to indicate which one. So I was hardwired for it. And I thought, oh, this is such a weird inquiry, and I'm so sick of this, and it's just all me, wrong, wrong, wrong. When I started to look at it, I realized, no, we're all enthralled to the sociopath, and that this hierarchy of corporations, et cetera, with these guys who rise up the ranks here, often have very, and one of the hallmarks is a lack of empathy. They do not have empathy. They do not have us. They don't have it. Oh, and it's always your fault. It's never their fault. It's your problem. So they tend to have this in common, where there's no empathy, where they cannot take responsibility for their particular part of the deal, and it's a pathology, and it's rampant in our culture. It's not just me, you know. And if we look at some of our people in politics who have a narcissistic personality disorder, you can look at them and see them, that we've all been sort of enthralled to this. I certainly have been personally enthralled to it. When I step back, I think, wow, this happy 1% we're talking about, 2%, is actually the percentage of sociopathy that you will find in any given culture is about, you know, about that percentage, that where they're that gone behind it. So I was thinking about this song. I thought, how can I put this in a song? Because what happened as a result of that last experience with this narcissist was it woke me up. And all of a sudden I saw my life started to make sense in a way. A lot of my own narcissism, et cetera, as far as being so invested in a persona rather than in my soul, et cetera. I had to look at this very clearly. And I thought,
well, what is good in it? What has been great? What was great is that it didn't kill me. It deepened my consciousness. It forced me to look at myself in a new way, and it forced me to broaden the understanding of what I was involved with in my life. And I really am grateful now. I'm not going to write the guy a letter or ask him to lunch, but this lesson taught me so much, and it helped seal the rest of my life to look back and see. So then, well, what is the use of evil in the world then? Well, if it doesn't kill you, and if you don't go down behind the illusion of its power, and you finally wake up from it, it dispels all of it, and you are on a different shore. You're on another shore. And so it's actually been a great friend to you. So I thought, well, I see, then that terrible experience really has helped to make me who I am today, and I'm grateful. Now, how do you write back a song? Well, I've been thinking about a buzzard for a long time, and how beautiful they are up in the air. Their flight is so gorgeous. And when they are up on the telephone poles, you know, way up there where they sun their wings, so beautiful. And they do a really, you know, hard and difficult job. And they're bad looking up close. So I kept thinking, I want to write this buzzard song, you know. But I was having a hard time with it. It was too much to pack into one song. So that one night I was sitting in my little cabin. This friend called me late at night, Rita Lee Shane, songwriter, and she said, how are you? I said, I'm having trouble with a buzzard song. She said, a buzzard song? What are you writing a buzzard song for anyway? And while we were talking, I'm sitting there, it's midnight, and there's this window that looks right out into this redwood tree, and as I'm talking to Brita, I look out and there's a buzzard. And he's standing right there as if he were Fido, you know, at my feet. If the window weren't there, he'd be Fido, you know. And he's looking at me. Now, the buzzards are all around my trees. And he's sitting there with his red, crepey neck and his bulgy eyes, you know, looking right at me. And I was looking right at him, and I wasn't afraid, and he wasn't afraid. It was just mysteriously wonderful. Yeah, I don't know what he was doing. And I'm saying, Brita, I'm looking at a buzzard, and he's looking at me. And we're just talking about this song. And then he kind of leaned into the window and tapped on it. I think it was the light or something. He was fascinated by something. He just tapped on the window. And then he spun around just slowly and walked into the forest. And it was an amazing experience. I wish I'd thought to open a can of cat food or something. You know, because it was so numinous, you know. It was just, and so, you know, Rita and I disengaged, and I went up to sleep, and I was in a state, you know, like I'd been visited. And the next morning I finished the song. I am now in the buzzard clan. Beautiful as he flies.
gets, the harder he is on your eyes. We all know someone like that was lovely from afar. But then you get to know them a bit and find out just who they are.
I want to thank you all so much for being here. I have CDs, which I'd love you to get. That would be great. It'd be very, very appreciated if you would want a CD. And this last song I wrote, I was just up in Seattle on tour. I was doing some shows up there. And I was given a house to stay in on a lake, which was great. I had 2 days in this wonderful house, and the lake was gorgeous. I woke up, I got there late at night after playing this little Wild West joint in Conway, you know, and I was way up in the wilderness, you know. And I got up there and followed this guy in his dark. He dropped me off at this house and said, oh, here you go. And in the morning I woke up and there's this beautiful lake. It was just grand. And it was very serene and placid, and it was like a mirror. And I thought, oh, I wish I could just stay in this state, looking out over this beautiful quiet. I thought, oh, my mind, if I could just be here. And as I was watching it, the lake, I saw that these bubbles were coming up. And I was looking at it, it was just, you know, kind of disrupting the peace, little bubbles. I thought, I don't know what's under there. So I wrote this song right there, and I sang it that night. It's ridiculous. It's called Bubbles. And I want to leave you with it because, first of all, you've been very, very attentive and very, and I thank you. And I hope we had a little of an inquiry tonight. I wish I had said, let's talk, but I went too long. So I would have preferred, you know, if we had a little dialogue going. And so I'm sorry about that part. I got carried away.
Good.
You just have to come back.
Yeah. Mm. But I thought it would be nice to leave you with this because it kind of tickles me. And it's better that also to know that our great calling in this to be alive at this time is a wonderful thing. As challenging as it may be, and as sad as we may be about the state of the earth and you know, all these things, our minds are so wonderful and our hearts are so great. Then when you get the two of them lined up, there's no telling what wonderful healing and what brilliant future humanity and the earth could have. So I'm very heartened because the people I know alive now seem to be really good for the job. So this one's called Bubbles. And it's my cat's new favorite. It is brand new. Thank you. And thank you for asking me to sing that time. Thank you, Anna. Bubbles are often indicators of hungry alligators who would love to chew someone just like you. Or portend mass migration of entire populations of dreadful gangs of things with fangs. Who knows? Bubbles means trouble. Bubbles spells beware. There's something going on under there. When you see them in a pool, if you go in, you're a fool. At the very least, something's been released. God knows what. And likewise, in a tub,
that you share with one you love. Don't be a dope, that bubble's not from soap, now you know. Leave the room. You may care to note their proclivity to float. Don't be seduced, you'll be reduced to thin air. For nothing's worse for your purse than a housing bubble that's burst. This ain't your granny, they'll kick your fanny, they don't play fair. So bubbles means troubles, bubbles bid adieu to everything you love, including you. Recall that online shopping, all that bubble wrap you could not stop popping. Well, you can bet they will not forget how you were wrong. And all those times you blew them before you even knew them. Well, it's a little late for that dinner date. Say, stop. Ha ha ha!